All right, we're registered chairs. Better be asleep at the switch than asleep at the mic.
Well, it sounded like nobody was here in that hearing yet. Okay, if we're ready to go, I'll go ahead and open it. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Senate Committee on Agricultural and Natural Resources. It's Thursday, May the 20th, 1999, and we're continuing an informational hearing on the salvage operations of the new Carissa. And so I would like to, at this time, declare us to be in an informational meeting. And we have invited testimony only. And what I'd like to do is have each person identify themselves. And then, Mr. Light, I'll have you probably go ahead, because we've talked with you about just telling this story about the ship, about what the potentials are, where you are now in the process of salvaging what's left of the new Carissa. And so if you try to get that mic a little closer, I can tell you you're going to need to be pretty close to the mic. And then each of you, just so we pick up your voice for the record, go ahead and introduce yourself, Mr. Light, and then pass the mic over and have everyone introduce themselves and go ahead and proceed.
My name is Mick Leitz, L-E-I-T-Z. I'm president of Fred Devine Dive-In Salvage Company in Portland. We operate the salvage ship, which is a salvage ship stationed in Astoria, Oregon.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, Senator Fisher C. Purchase, Assistant Director at the Division of State Lands.
Pass the mic over. Captain.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, Paul Sleiman, Manager of Environmental Cleanup Program, which includes the spill program for Department of Environmental Quality.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, my name is Captain Paul Amos. I'm with the Columbia River Pilots and current Vice President.
Good to have you all here tonight. Appreciate you coming. We should have more members here within just a short amount of time. Mr. Light, I'll let you go ahead and proceed.
Okay. as you all know, the new Carissa grounded on February the 4th, sometime during the early morning. The Devine Company was contacted about the stranding from a couple of different sources. One was Captain Gary Davis, who's a retired bar pilot at Coos Bay. He called me about 9 o'clock in the morning. He said there was a ship around down there. A fellow by the name of John Murdoch, who's a Marine surveyor, happened to be in Coos Bay and heard about it and called me at about 9:10. And about 9:30, Bill Milwee gave me a call and essentially said that the ship was aground and gave me what information he had and how fast could we get underway. I made several phone calls to helicopter companies and what have you. Called the salvage chief at 10:30 that morning, told them to get involved. I'd talked to him a couple times before that. And the salvage chief is stationed, is in ready-to-go condition with a couple of exceptions. In this particular instance, we only had about 20,000 gallons of fuel on board, all 70. And we had to get fuel. We also keep a three-man standby crew 40 hours a week to maintain the vessel. And the Coast Guard required crew is 9. As a practical matter, to operate in a salvage situation, we have to have about 13 or 14 on board to handle all the rigging and everything. So we immediately pulled out all the stops and started calling in people. There are a lot of people that have worked on the salvage ship over the years. We have a list of them, and we have to go down the list and find out who's available and who can make it and what have you. We actually got fairly lucky that day because by 1:45 in the afternoon, we had an entire crew on board. We're loading equipment. A lot of the equipment on a job like this particular one, the equipment's in a warehouse down there, so we have to bring it out of the warehouse, load it on board the ship, depends on the circumstances, what kind of a job we're going on. So the crew worked all day long doing all that sort of stuff. In the city of Astoria, they only had 20,000 gallons of fuel in the whole town, so they had to truck fuel in from Portland to the oil dock down there so we could refuel up.
Mr. Chair, did you say 70,000 gallons is what you carry and you had 20,000 on board?
Yeah, we have more than about 25 or 28,000 on board.
So you literally needed,
we ended up
tankers?
Yeah, we put 38,000 gallons on board, additional fuel.
So you had about maybe even as much as seven or eight tankers then that had to come in.
Yeah.
Now, those are the things that's too bad that somehow or another that doesn't get into the newspaper because people have no idea. You know, I didn't myself, and I know that there's a lot of fuel on that, but I just supposed that you had service stations along the dock and things like that.
Well, there's not too much in the real world.
Interrupting, but I was amazed that when I was, you know, you start doing this, you just don't have any understanding of what it takes to get something underway.
Well, the salvage chief has been maintained on station in Astoria since 1950. Historically, the salvage chief was gainfully employed about 65 days a year. In the last 6 years, it's been gainfully employed 6 days a year. We used to keep the tanks full, and we used to keep nearly a full crew on it all the time. But in these economic times, in the salvage industry, you can't do it. The truth of the matter is there's millions and millions, perhaps billions of dollars spent on sopping up oil after it escapes from vessels. Nothing is spent on maintaining salvage capability, which about 95% of the time can prevent massive pollution. Well, one of the things I've done in the past is salvage the Exxon Valdez. I was a salvage master on it, and my company was a prime salvage contractor for that little junket. You know, you take that particular case, 81% of the fuel or of the cargo was still on board the ship. Only 19% got out of it, and that oil was taken off the ship, you know, without spilling anything more, which is a kind of a remarkable feat. You know, maybe I should get back to the scenario. Is that what you want?
No, that, you're doing fine, because that's, you know, what you said about the idea of the economic times, and now, you know, we don't have financial ability to have the ship ready to go at all times is part of the question that we wanted to ask. And after the first meeting that we had, that question was raised very heavily in my mind. What do we need to do to make sure that the ship, in fact, is prepared to go? And I think we're very fortunate. It's been very fascinating for me to be doing this research and realize that we have one of the finest salvage ships, I think on the West Coast, isn't it, here in the state.
That's correct.
Assistant owner.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Are you the one that has it? What's it called? King? Queen?
Salvage chief.
Chief.
Yeah.
Are you on it?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Oh.
Yeah. Lars Larson thinks highly of you.
That's good. Now, it was kind of a coincidence about a month before this happened. Northwest Field Guide from Channel 10, you know, the PBS, they did a deal on the salvage chief. It was about a 7 or 8 minute deal. It was, and it was aired in the middle of the new Carissa affair, so somebody thought we'd done it especially for that, and it wasn't at all. It was done about a month before it happened.
But was the salvage chief involved in the new Carissa?
Well, only
at the end?
A little bit. Yeah, that's what I'm going to get into here.
Oh, yeah.
It's just got transition time because we're talking about, you know, on the 4th, when they got the notice and decided to get fueled and ready to go, and Senator Fisher had asked about the enormous amount of fuel that was necessary that had to be transported to the salvage chief just before they could even leave.
Has anybody ever told us why they weren't involved earlier?
You may be able to ask that question. That's why we're back here.
Well, I guess to get this thing kind of in a nutshell, we were contacted by Milwee at 9:30 in the morning. I actually thought we had a job. We pulled out all the stops to mobilize, and at 6:30 on the 4th, I was called by Milwee and told that Smith was hired. We never slowed down. We kept mobilizing. I figured if the salvage chief could get down to Coos Bay, we could probably get a job out of it anyhow. So we went ahead, and that day I spent almost $100,000 getting out of town, you know, getting hiring crew and fueling up and everything else we did. Bought a bunch of wine and stuff, and I think that came up here at the hearing last week. It was one of the reasons why we couldn't get away, and that had nothing to do with it at all. The wine was shipped on a truck from Seattle to Coos Bay, and it was down the next morning, and we were going to fly it out. On the 4th, I hired helicopters. You know, all the helicopters that you've seen in the news, I hired in the first place. They were all working for us. In fact, I sent a small helicopter down at the request of Mr. Milwee on the 4th so he could use it for go out and take a look at the ship, and also I think it was used by some of the environmental groups to kind of assess the situation. And of course, by that first day, there was no oil leaking. So anyhow, we sent the helicopter down at Milwee's request. So I can't help but think that because of certain things that happened, Milwee called a number of times during the day to ask how we were coming along with our mobilization. He's very familiar with our company. So I really kind of thought we had a job. But at 6:30 that night, he called up and said that the good job was given to Schmidt. When he called me, I was on a derrick barge picking up a burned-up boat over in the Columbia River, and I told him I'd get back to him when I got ashore. So when I got ashore, I called him up at home to find out more about what had happened. You know, why didn't we get a job? And he simply said I should get a hold of Schmidt. Schmidt wanted us to subcontract to them. And I tried to call Schmidt that night, and they never called me back.
Just a second. Who told you to call Schmidt?
Mr. Milwee.
Okay.
Yeah, Ms. Weitz, my understanding was that a Japanese underwriter made that decision, or do you know the circumstances on why that decision was made to pull you guys out of that?
I really think that's probably the truth. I think that Schmidt's a very large organization, and I think they have representatives in Japan. And I think when an incident like this happens, they've got somebody sitting on the underwriter's doorstep immediately. And I really think that it probably wasn't in Mr. Milwee's hands to make the decision. I think he's probably in a position to make some sort of recommendations. But I think that, in all fairness, that the decision was probably out of his hands, too. I think it was, you know, made in Japan, you know, by Schmidt's representative and the underwriters.
I just have a question.
Certainly, no.
How could somebody in Japan make a decision? Why wouldn't they empower the people here that had the ship? I mean, that were, you know, here.
Well, the owners are Japanese. The original, all the machinery underwriters are Japanese. In Japan, it's a little different game than you have here. There's an outfit called Nippon Salvage that is it's a Japanese salvage company, very capable. Their vessels are funded by the Japanese insurance industry, so they have a rather large budget. But when a Japanese underwriter or Japanese ship owner has a casualty just about anywhere in the world, they will go to Nippon Salvage and ask for their advice on who to hire and that type of thing. And I met a fellow from the insurance company and also a fellow from Nippon Salvage that came over here. And I talked to him a little bit, not very much, but so I think that decision was made over there. I think it's just the way it's done. The owners are there, their underwriters are there, or at least the Hull and Machinery underwriters are there. Of course, the P&I underwriters, after the thing become a constructive total loss team, Hull and Machinery underwriters leave the situation. They just will simply pay off the mechanics of that is the owners, after they believe it to be a constructive total loss, tender something called abandonment to the underwriters. And the underwriters refuse to accept abandonment because they don't want the responsibility. But then that triggers the payoff. You know, what makes a constructive total loss is that the estimated cost of salvage and repairs exceed the insured value of the vessel. And that's what happened in this case. When the engine room flooded, it was no longer an economically viable situation. I've never heard for sure, but one estimate I got on the insured value was only in the neighborhood of about $4 million. And actually, when the vessel that size, I actually thought it was probably worth about eight, you know, seven or eight or something like that. When I heard later on it was only worth four. So it wouldn't take very much to make a constructive total loss out of it. You can't rebuild an engine room for $4 million.
Who at this point? It appears that it's on the 4th and the 5th that basically the authority to deal with the problem shifted from us to the underwriters, to the Japanese authorities. They were making the decision. Was there anyone in state government who had the authority or anyone in government who had the authority to make the decision about what was going to proceed, how we were going to proceed?
I would really seriously doubt it. I suppose the Coast Guard would be about the closest thing to something that you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe the Coast Guard can't really intercede as long as something positive is happening. You know, if the owners are demonstrating a willingness to provide assistance and, you know, funding it, their underwriters are funding it, I don't think the Coast Guard can interfere unless there's something massively wrong. You know, and on day one, it's pretty hard to say that anything's wrong, you know, because it takes a little time for anybody to respond to any kind of an emergency.
Why don't you go back to your timetable and let's work right on through that. So you were filling the fuel, found out that there was a problem, the job may not be there, and from that point.
Yeah, we never slowed down at all. You know, at 6:30 that night, I found out that we didn't have a job, but we went ahead and fueled the ship up, continued to mobilize, you know, put equipment on board and everything we needed to go. And at 4:30 on the 5th, the morning of the 5th, the salvage chief finished fueling, and he could have left sometime after that. They tried to cross the bar on the low water slack tide, which was the next day around noon. They left. They got underway at 12:45 on the 5th. You know, headed out. At 13:47, they were on the bar in the 75-knot winds and 25-foot seas, and the captain decided it would be the prudent thing to do was turn around and go back in. So he did.
Had the Coast Guard actually closed the bar and said, don't cross?
Well, it's actually the pilots that kind of decide if it's navigable or not, I believe. Isn't that
bar
correct?
Bar
pilots.
Okay.
I flew down to Coos Bay and arrived there at 10 o'clock in the morning.
On the 5th.
Okay. And I had three helicopters, and nobody asked me to get a fixed-wing airplane. There were some people from Fish and Wildlife or something like that wouldn't ride in helicopters. So they wanted a twin-engine fixed-wing airplane to look at the beach. So I arranged for that. Did all sorts of things that morning. I think Schmidt arrived sometime. There were people arrived sometime around 2 or 3 in that afternoon. And I talked to them just briefly. They wanted to know if the salvage chief was on its way, and I told them we're bringing it down. You know, I didn't have any agreement with them for anything, but I told them we're bringing it down for whatever we could do. The equipment that I mentioned earlier, the rope and everything that arrived from Seattle that morning, you know, a whole semi-load of, well, we had spare anchors and rope and that type of thing.
And what day was that?
On Friday the 5th.
On the 5th, okay.
Right.
So that tow rope was there on the 5th.
Right.
Okay.
And the salvage chief turned back up about 2 o'clock, so they went back to the dock. You know, Saturday the 6th, the salvage chief was stuck in Astoria all day because of weather. On Sunday the 7th, the salvage chief got underway at 12 noon and crossed the bar. It was still pretty shaky conditions, but they chugged on down there. And they arrived the 8th, which is Monday, at 19:45 in Coos Bay. And incidentally, in the meantime, I managed to put together this subcontract thing with Schmidt, and they finally signed it when the salvage chief was already there. You know, so we purely speculated on whether we'd ever get anything out of this or not. Let's see here. On the 9th, the salvage chief arrived in the evening of the 8th. On the 9th, you know, we were now working for Schmidt. And they had requested a bunch of our portable equipment, like hydraulic-powered pumps for dewatering and things like that, which we had trucked down from Portland. And that stuff was all there. The salvage chief crew and the people that I had come down from Portland flew all this equipment out to the new Carissa for Schmidt with my helicopters. By this time, we had a big helicopter there, too. The Vertol had arrived. And so all day, the day of the 9th, the salvage chief crew and my Portland crew put equipment on board the ship. On the 10th, on the morning of the 10th, we were requested by Schmidt to go out and see if we get a line on the ship. So at 7:20, we sailed from Coos Bay, Empire, at the entrance of Coos Bay. We were at 8:20 in the morning, we were off the new Carissa, and we backed into 3,100 feet from the direct of the new Carissa. And We were in 25-foot seas. The salvage chief lost 10 foot of water, and there was 40 foot of water, you know, 3,100 foot from where the new Carissa was resting. And at 9:14, to be exact, Smith called and told us to return to port that the engine room had flooded. And then at 9:55, they called us and told us the salvage chief was simply dismissed. You know, the salvage chief proceeded back into Coos Bay because we had some equipment on the dock. We had to load up and then the following morning on the 11th, it left for Astoria.
Mr. Light, the reason, if I understand this right, the reason that the decision was made to pull you out, even though you were within 3,100 feet, was the idea that with the flooded engine room, that the, basically the ship had reached its $4 million. In other words, they were going to pay it off.
That's
the
right.
Ship was a loss. She's totaled, in other words.
That's right. It was a constructive total loss at that point in time. And Schmidt was working on a contract with all the machinery underwriters. They eventually, or ultimately, negotiated something with the Britannia Club, which is the P&I underwriters, and continued on.
So we're going to basically pick up now the environmental impact and the disposal of the remaining part of the ship. Is that correct? That, in other words, the, those that second tier of underwriters pick up the responsibility for salvage and for the environmental impact.
Well, that's right. They started paying the bills for removing the bow from the beach, for example, all the way up until they got it out and sunk. In fact, they're still, they're the people that we have a contract with to remove the stern of it now. Mm-hmm. We were the successful bidder for taking the stern out. I should qualify that. We were 50% interest in the bid. Don John Marine out of Hillside, New Jersey, they're actually our partner, have the other half interest in the operation to remove the stern.
Explain to me now, because this has always been a problem. We were told last time we met on this issue that basically the ship, once it fractured, it was going to break. And so it wasn't really starting a fire in there. In fact, several people have assured me that basically we didn't burn much fuel. But the question is, always been on my mind, would we have been better off to got that thing out of the surf and had it actually floating, even if it fractured broke? Has there been any speculation about that issue? In other words, you were there, you were ready to roll on the 10th, and could have, how long before a rope could have been, or cable, whatever you would have used to have actually removed it?
We could have went out on the morning of the 9th. The salvage chief got there in the evening of the 8th. We could have went out and got a line on it the morning of the 9th, not messed around flying equipment to the New Carissa. So it would have been possible to have got a line on it the 9th. Had the bow been swung into the sea, it would have rode better. You know, the ship probably would have survived longer. This particular ship is built out of high tensile steel, which is very brittle, very strong, but once it starts failing, it just shatters. You know, there was a period of about 15 years, they built out a tanker out of high tensile steel, and they've had continuing problems, you know, with fractures and cracks and what have you. And what all that was about is, you could build a ship out of thinner steel, and so therefore it was lighter and it could haul more cargo. And this ship is high tensile steel. The Exxon Valdez was high tensile steel. But I think that, in my opinion, that contributed to why it failed as quick as it did. But there's a few other reasons that I think why it broke up quite so quick. I was just surprised everybody else that it broke up as quick as it did. I've seen a lot of shipwrecks, and I've never seen one fall apart quite so fast. But
yeah, particularly, the thing that amazed me is, as we first started to get really clear pictures, the fact that that was after that ship appeared to be in excellent condition, then we found out it really wasn't that old of construction.
No, it's like a 10-year-old ship, and it was well-maintained. I've been aboard it since, of course, after it burned, but nevertheless, there's not a lot of wastage or anything like that. And, it was pretty well-maintained. There's always a lot of discussion about what you should do with a shipwreck on the beach, you know, particularly in heavy weather. You know, one of the theories is ballast it down, you know, make it heavy, make it sort of stand still. My experience has been that, with few exceptions, that if the vessel's lighter, it still gets picked up and gets bounced, but it will survive longer than if you ballast it down because it's just simply heavier, and the seas still pick it up, and it just bounces harder, you know, and they seem to come apart a lot quicker. Another little theory here, too, that I've heard down there that the number four cargo hold is also a ballast tank. And which they have leaning ballast tanks at the bottom of the holes in the inner bottoms, and they run along port and starboard. On the outside, fuel tanks are down the middle, which should normally would tend to protect the fuel tanks, you know, somewhat. And then on a chip ship like this, the number four cargo hold is actually a ballast tank. It has to be filled clear to the deck with water, so you don't have free surface in it when it's underway. But that's how you get enough weight in the ship so it can travel light across the ocean. I heard on about the second or third day I was there that the water level in that thing had dropped some 15, 20 feet. That's where it went through, and they were thinking it was leaking in the number five hatch and six. The bulkhead between five and six hatch is not watertight. Neither is the one between the bulkhead between number two and number three hatch. It's a non-watertight bulkhead, which is kind of interesting on a big freight ship like that. But anyhow, the ship is broadside to the sea, and you have this number four tank that's, you know, some 10, 15, 20 foot slack, and the ship is rocking violently, and I can't help but, you know, the crack occurred, the initial crack that occurred in the port side of number five hatch. You can get the ship rolling one way and the water going the opposite direction, which would create an interesting twisting motion in the vessel itself, which could have exacerbated the cracking. But I guess that's really neither here nor there. You know, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. But the crack started developing in the side of number five before the fire or anything like that. And I personally think that the ship would have probably broken and, you know, 24 to 48 hours with or without the fire. I think the fire probably speeded it up a little bit, and that's about all you can say for it. You know, it was destined to happen. The thing, to chug on here a little bit, the Salvage Chief sailed for Astoria the morning of the 11th. It left Coos Bay at 7 o'clock in the morning, bound for Astoria. That's the day that the Coast Guard tried to burn the ship using hand grenades, I believe, and gasoline, when it failed. And then on Friday, they came in, and that's when they actually put the napalm in there and tried to get the fire going on Friday. When the ship broke in two, I seen on television, went in and down in the morning, talked to the people from Schmidt and said, why don't we turn the Salvage Chief around and send it back? Because I think we can get the bow out. I seen the thing on television and the bow didn't look like much of a salvage bow, so we can come back. And the weather had moderated. And actually, the weather prediction was for more bad weather, but it didn't happen. And so I told them that we should bring the Salvage Chief back. I think we can get the bow out of there promptly. In fact, I think I told them something like 48 hours, and I'll stick to that. But and I realize that I can be accused of Monday morning quarterbacking or 2020 hindsight or all those sort of things, but I've been doing this for 40 years, and I know what our ship can do, and I know what my people can do, and I know damn good and well to pull that thing out of there promptly.
Okay, now let me get that straight. On the 12th, then, the napalm was used. Is that when it was it that night it broke in half? So with the
13th? I don't know. The Salvage Chief left on the 11th. Wait a minute. They used the hand grenades on the 10th. I'm one day off here.
Oh, okay.
And then they set the actual fire to the thing on the 11th. It was a morning. Let's see. The hand grenades were on the 10th, wasn't it? Anybody know?
Anybody knows, go ahead and just speak up. Identify yourself for the record, and then if we know these things.
Yeah. Ball here.
Okay, that would have been 11.
The 10th was that Wednesday was the failed hand grenade burn, and the following evening was the napalm and the tape charges, and then it was late that night that you could clearly see the two portions of the ship that you alluded to, that the fire may have opened it up more, or exacerbated the fracture.
Okay, now, what was the plan on the attempt? What was the plan? They sent you home. You're going to head home on 11. What was the plan to deal with the ship at that point? Do we know that?
Well, I don't know. The Coast Guard had stepped in and they were going to burn the oil. That was all I knew about. The plan was to try and reduce the quantity of oil that was in the ship. The ship, like Paul said, it broke in half sometime the 9 or 11 to the morning of the 12th. The salvage ship was on its way up the coast. I seen the news thing on television down there and realized that the bow could be refloated fairly easily. I went down, Schmidt's people were having breakfast in the same hotel I was at, and I went down about 7 o'clock in the morning and said, let's turn the salvage ship around and I think we can get that bow out there pretty promptly. I was told that they had a better idea. And that was the end of that conversation. And I don't know. I think that's all I want to say about it.
I don't want to put you on the spot. And I know because you're still working this issue, and so don't, you don't need to say anything you don't want to say. But at that point, we recognized that what ended up being taken to high seas and sunk basically was sitting on the beach at that time. Was there any quantity whatsoever that was burned off of that of the bow?
Are you asking me how much oil burnt? That's an interesting question.
I've had a few people tell me.
I personally don't think it was a huge amount, and the reason is that in order to make a fire inside of a ship, you got to have some kind of ventilation. And I think about the best way I can explain it is that if you had a burn barrel in your backyard, threw a bunch of stuff in it and lit it, it wouldn't burn very well. It'd sit there and smolder for a long time. But if you poked a bunch of holes at the bottom of it, then you can it'll act as a burn barrel. Mm-hmm. A ship isn't much different than that. They blasted the holes in the tank top. They had the napalm in it. It's supposed to ignite this stuff. But you got to bring a black oil up to the point of vaporization before it'll burn, which means you have to increase the temperature. And the only access that you had to the double bottom tank where the oil was contained was through these splits in the deck. So a very small amount of that was exposed to the fire. There's no question about it. It burned some oil. Mm-hmm. But I think that engineers could probably calculate that pretty accurately. And naval architects, that type of thing. But I think because of lack of ventilation, I think it was actually eventually proven to some extent by the fact that there was a large quantity of oil still in the bow after the fires went out. You know, they tried to relight it and everything else, and it didn't do much good. They couldn't relight it. But cold bunker oil is very hard to light.
Right.
You could put a cigarette out on it and not worry about it. You could, in fact, if you took a cutting torch, a gas cutting torch, and stuck it in there, it would take a little while before you could get it to burn. You'd have to warm it up enough until it vaporized. That's its flash point. So
okay. So 11th were two pieces. Decisions made to continue. At what point? Because my schedule just ends right there. At what point did we actually then get the ship moved? Why don't you just go ahead from, let's say, for the 12th?
Well,
Friday the 12th.
After there, I didn't. Schmidt was running the job. And somewhere around there, I headed back for port. I eventually went back down again, and the Vine Company put together a boiler setup to heat oil. And this was in cooperation with the Coast Guard and the burning efforts. You know, the Coast Guard was going to pump the oil off the ship,
mm-hmm.
and we were going to heat it up so it could be pumped. But they were going to pump it cold to shore. And then we were going to heat it so they could put it in tanks or tankers and haul it out of there. But that wasn't a very successful operation. We got the boiler up and running and all that kind of people. We had people standing by to do it. You know, eventually there was 127,000 gallons of water pumped ashore and 283 gallons of oil. And that was the end of that.
In your estimation, I'm assuming from all the research I've done that we actually did burn very little fuel, particularly in that bow section. If that could have been removed immediately, let's say because you were ready to connect on the 9th, probably could have pulled it easy the 9th or the 10th, got the bow out of there. Why was the decision made not to do that? Do we have anybody that knows that answer? Because one of the things that bothered me, and the reason I've done this twice now, is I'm trying to figure out who must be responsible for this. There needs to be somebody who has authority to say, no, we're going to move on this thing. We're going to move now. And I said earlier that, you know, to me, when I look at this event, it's time is of the essence. We were told last time that this ship is going to break out, period. Anytime one part's stuck in sand or rocks and the other is sitting out of the ocean, any ship is going to come apart.
There was a lot of discussions about taking the oil off of that ship down there, and I was involved in a few of them. You know, this was while I was waiting for the Salvi sheet to come down there. The truth of the matter is, you know, in fairness to everybody, there was no practical way to do it. I mean, they spent hours, you know, trying to do all these scenarios. The ship was about 1,000 foot offshore. They talked about submerged lines, but coal oil, there's only about 600-700 foot through coal, submerged hose, and they couldn't pump any oil through it. And the ship was pretty well standing still. When the ship initially went aground out there and got broadside, it was rocking violently. It would have been extremely difficult for anybody to have pumped any significant amount of oil off of it. I think that any kind of an effort, I think the oil would have had been flowing off there, pumping the tanks and flowing off there. But under those conditions, the weather was terrible. And the ship, you know, once it got to be broadside, it was rocking violently, you know. And I don't think I would have... I don't think anybody could have done much about taking the oil off. In most instances, I've had a couple of situations where the Coast Guard insisted we take the oil off of a vessel before we could even try to salvage it. I went up in Alaska, a fishing vessel worth $2 million, and we only had one little break in the weather, and they insisted we pump oil off, so we pumped about half the oil off. We lost the weather window, the boat actually came afloat on the changing tide, properly capsized. It was floating on beam's end. We towed it out, floating on beam's end. In other words, like just laying on its side, floated it out, and the Coast Guard shot a couple of holes and sunk it. Now, the other half of the oil was still in the thing. You know, no, it never got out. If we had concentrated on refloating it, we could have succeeded in that weather window. But we spent our time... That was, you know, one instance for the Coast Guard. I've had other instances when you explain to the Coast Guard that we're better off using our time to try and refloat the whole vessel, and we'll get the oil, too. And they bought on it, and it was successful.
But is one of you folks that can help me with this, because, I don't know maritime law, but one of the things that I'm wondering about is it seems like we never did establish who had the control over this situation. And you would have thought the Coast Guard would have been the one that said, no, this is the way we're going to proceed. They seemed to be insecure. They were waiting for the Japanese underwriters to make a decision, this sort of thing. Can we, as a state, make a decision that if this happens again, this will be the process? The ship will immediately respond. We will immediately try to refloat that ship or have a plan that would be backing up based upon other experience, because ships are running the ground constantly. This should be a science. And can you tell us a little bit about that? Is it something new? In other words, our sense of the environment, let's remove the oil, may in fact be creating another problem by the fact that we're not expediting the removal of the ship from whatever it's caught on. Help me here. First
well,
of all,
general,
maritime law. Can we
well,
get jurisdiction?
I'm not a lawyer.
Okay.
But since the Exxon Valdez ship salvage has gotten to be a little bit more formal, and every year it gets to be worse. You know, with the rules and regulations, it used to be we went out and did our darndest to save the thing, with very little interference from any place. After the Exxon Valdez, that's when this incident command system got started, or the unified command, whatever you want to call it. I personally don't like it, and I probably get shot for saying that, but it's too cumbersome. You can't have 23 bosses trying to run one train. You know, it really doesn't work. It's just simply too cumbersome. You got the weather, you know, the weather to contend with. That used to be our major problem, is contending with the weather. Now that's come become number two. Contending with the bureaucracy is number one. And I, well, you know, long fight to maintain all this, I realize that, but it's sort of my nature.
Even 25C takes a second seat to the level of bureaucracy.
But, you know, the incident command system was originally designed, I guess, for firefighting. I guess they do that very successful. I'm not convinced that it works in ship salvage situations at all. And I, you know, for the last 3-4 years now, I run into it a lot. And the reason that it doesn't work very well is because a wrecked vessel is a perishable commodity, and time is absolutely of the essence. And the weather changes minutely or hourly or whatever, and you have to be able to respond. If you look back at this situation from one and the other, day after day after day, everything was reactive, never proactive. Nobody anticipated what's going to happen and got the equipment there ahead of time. They wait a little. It happened, and then bring the craft in after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's not effective. And I'm
well,
too outspoken, aren't I?
That's why we invited you guys back, because, you know, if somehow out of this process, we must come up with a plan. And whether we have to get approval from the federal government to say, this is what we're going to be Oregon's plan to responding for something like this, and we want you to sign off and set up a process in which we can put the people who know how to salvage a ship in charge of the thing. Also, let's deal with the idea. The containment ships, we already have those standing by, right, as far as the containment. So they were on site, ready to go, if, in fact, a pull could have been initiated. Is that correct?
What do you mean by containment ships? Like the Oregon responder?
Yeah, the responder.
Spill response? Yeah, there's all kinds of provisions for that. In fact, all the spill response companies have retainers, you know, to help them survive. And there's a lot of spill response companies that can bring stuff in, but it's all after the fact type response.
Mm-hmm. But what I was suggesting was we had that ship that there. So in other words, if in fact we decided to remove this thing, let's get it off here fast, because this thing, you know, here I am sitting in Salem, we're in committees, but I'm watching that thing down there, and even though it wasn't my district, I care about the coast. So, but my thought was, why are we waiting? I mean, it just seemed like there was nothing that was going well. And as each day goes by, you saw the conditions get worse and worse and worse.
Yeah.
If, in fact, we could have made the decision to do the pull initially and then had ships there that could have, in fact, dealt with any spill that might have developed, it appears that the spill went on just the same. If you'd have had two pieces offshore, two pieces, you know, stuck in the sand, we were in exactly the same position as far as the amount of leakage. Is that correct, or is anybody, I'd like
well,
to put that straight in my mind.
You're asking about who's in control. In this day and age, who is in control is the incident command, the unified command. You got the Coast Guard is involved, they're one member of it. The state has a member on it, and the owner has a member on it. And that's who is in control, the Atrika. And then it's all part of the unified command. There's 23, 24 various agencies in Oregon that all have some... have the right or the responsibility to have some kind of an input into the situation. And I think it's, you know, my own personal opinion is it's just cumbersome. I think everybody is well-intentioned. There's no question about it. And they work hard. And I think the best way to prevent pollution is prompt salvage, you know, prompt professional salvage. I think in this particular case, you know, fairness to everybody involved, the weather was extremely bad down there, and it was very difficult for anybody to do much in that first few days because of the conditions. It was really bad. Yeah, but I think if I had to say a mistake was made is that they didn't hire us to pull a bow section out of there. You know, it wouldn't have got bounced up and down the coast for 5 or 6 weeks dribbling oil as it went. I think I'm positive we could have pulled that thing out in just a few days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, well, I'll give you another little situation. Here's a few weeks ago, like 3 weeks ago, one of Crowley's urea barges went around in Young's Bay down to the mouth of the Columbia River. And we, Crowley called us up and hired us, and to go down and pull on it. We got the call about 4 o'clock. We were connected to that barge by about 9 o'clock that same night, and we pulled that night, but, you know, because of some we weren't going the right direction, but we just hooked on where they told us to. But so the next morning we evaluated the situation, hooked on the opposite end, and managed to get the barge afloat. The barge grounded on an 8.4 tide. We refloated on a 7.8 foot tide. In other words, a falling tide. The barge was carrying 12,400 tons of urea. The barge itself weighed something in excess of 3,000 tons. So you got a combined weight of something in excess of 15,000 tons. It's a foot out of draft on the tide. You know, the thing went around at high water on an 8.4 tide, so it was a foot out of it. Now, by comparison, we managed to pull out of there two tides. You know, we hooked on it one night, didn't get it. We evaluated the situation, pulled on the opposite end of it, and managed to refloat on the next high water, you know, 12 hours later. Two tides. The bow of the new Carissa was sitting in the surf, bouncing up and down. It wasn't really hard to ground, and only weighed 4,000 tons. You know, pretty close to one-fourth the weight that we dealt with in Astoria. And the waves do help refloat things, because they lift it and move it and lift it. Now, the difference between using a tug and a salvage ship to pull a vessel off is that the salvage ship goes out, we drop three anchors to sea, and connect three tow lines up to the wreck. You tighten the winches all up, and when a swell comes by and lifts the ship a little bit, you pull it. I mean, it moves, and you can hold it from going back on the beach.
It's basically like a big fish on line. You know, you're going to pull in when you get slack.
The salvage sheet pulls 300 tons, which is roughly the equivalent of 30,000 horsepower and propeller power. That's open wheel.
Say that one more time for me.
The salvage sheet pulls 300 tons, which is about the equivalent of 30,000 propeller horsepower. You take pulling on a wreck like this with a tugboat, you know, they advertise bollard pull on this particular tug. It was 106 tons, I believe. Now, the tug itself is wheeled. In other words, the propellers are designed to screw their way out through the water probably at 9 or 10 knots with a tow on behind it. When you take that tug and tie it to an object that isn't moving, you have to slow the engine down, and you end up overheating the engines, because it's like taking your car into a stump and pulling on it in high gear or something like that. It's just, it can't do it. I would suspect that during the whole time they were pulling on the new Carissa, for example, that they were probably running at 65-70% of power of their, because it isn't wheeled to be standing still, and the engines, I mean, you just simply overheat the engines if you try and do it.
About what horsepower?
Pardon?
That on the tug at 65-70% would yield what horsepower?
Well, I don't know. Just with the vessel rated at 7,200.
Okay.
You know, and but that would be at its design speed, not on a dead pole.
Not a dead pole, right? Okay.
I mean, some of the stuff, I don't know if you're interested in it or not. It's just little tidbits.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does paint a picture, and that is. What is the part of the analysis of what are you going to do with the wreck is? You have to know what equipment has the capacity to actually deal with the problem.
Right.
They had decided probably to go to the tug because of the fact that they saw that valve was bouncing in the surf and didn't assume it would be much of a pull.
Yeah, but I don't, you know, the thing I've always questioned is you've got a vessel that was designed specifically for salvage work in the Pacific Northwest sitting there, or actually not way back that story, but readily available. Why wait 2 or 3 days for a tug to come from somewhere else?
That was my
Why send to Holland for a piece of rope when they manufacture it, never in Washington?
Right. Now, and so the rope was down there on the 5th. That was your rope.
That was our rope, yes.
Okay. Then, and that's, okay. And then by the 9th, you were ready to pull. All right. Now, when did the tug that was finally used, what date did it arrive?
You know, I don't have any records of that.
Okay.
So I really can't comment. I mean, I was around down there and watched this deal, but it took them 2 or 3 days to get there. And came into port, spent a day or two in port, went out, backed into the, or tried to back in, and they, you know, they were 4,800 foot off the beach, I guess, and they didn't want to go any further. In rough comparison, obviously she draws about 10 foot of water. That tug draws 22 foot of water. We were at 3,100 feet from the wreck, and they were at 4,800 foot. Their tow line is 2,700 foot long, and Schmidt was privy to that information. I don't know why they couldn't have figured out the 2,700 foot wouldn't reach. You know, if they'd have backed a 22 foot draft tug into where we were at, it'd have been bouncing off the bottom big time.
It had two poles. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, I think we're getting in an area where you probably were out of the picture, and now we're bringing you back to the picture because you're going to be responsible for the final salvage, if I understand that's correct, with assurance.
Yes.
Okay.
In cooperation with my partners, of course.
All right. Tell us about that, because one of the issues I understand is you still have a lot of agencies to deal with, and it's a case, too. We want to make sure that the plan, if something like this should develop again, if there is a plan to continue also with as rapid a possible salvage of that and to remove it from the shore. So can you tell us a bit about how that's going?
Well, we are, of course, won the contract, signed the contract. Our derrick has sailed from New York the night before last. It's going to proceed to the Gulf of Mexico. We're going to load a jack-up platform on the deck of the derrick, take it to Panama. We have to unload it in Panama, take the two vessels through Panama, the canal, reload it, and come up to Cruz Bay. It's going to take about 30 days before I get here. We're in the process of mobilizing everything else. We're probably... we had meetings this week with DEQ and the Department of Lands and with Gallagher's group, Mr. Milwee, you know, just getting all the stuff in order. And we proceed with getting the permits. I've been talking to him just, was it yesterday? Yeah. And this is a little bit different situation in a lot of ways than a salvage situation, in that this kind of is almost static. Time is still of the essence. Things can happen to that stern yet, you know, but it's at a slower pace than when you got a ship bouncing up and down in the surf. But nevertheless, time is still somewhat of the essence. For example, the house on the stern of the New Caressa weighs something in the neighborhood of 500 tons, and it's sitting, the hull of the ship is something like a box beam, and it's supporting this weight sitting on top of it, but the stern is slightly tweaked out of alignment, and it's supporting all this weight. So one of the things that we'd like to do early on is take some of that weight off the top of it to preserve it to the hull as long as we possibly can. And so we will proceed with that as soon as we can, removing the superstructure. And the other thing that we will continue to do on board the ship is monitor the any oil that accumulates inside of it and any deterioration of the structure. And that'll be done. Hopefully, we'll start working on the house on June 1. We'll start on that little project. And it's about 30 days, and we'll have the big equipment here and get after the hull itself. And that's kind of where we're at. Talked to all the people we believe we need to talk to concerning pollution and the pollution plans and whose responsibility it is, and what permits we need and what people, you know, everybody's concerned about. And I think all the meetings went very well. I think that we also met with the Coast Guard. They're primarily safety concerns at this point in time with them. In fact, we've had crews working on the ship for about the last 4 weeks or something, in cooperation or what have you with Global Diving out of Seattle. We used our pumps to pump a considerable amount of oil out of the stern of the vessel, which has gone very well. Global Environmental has cleaned the engine room. We had divers dive in the engine room, and we opened up the tanks. A lot of them we hot tapped, which is boring a hole in them, connecting a hose to it, and sending the oil out of them. Some of them we just simply opened. This was at the direction of the Coast Guard, and the oil just come up in the engine room, and Global's people stopped it all up. And it's, I understand, I haven't been there the last few days, but I guess it's really, really clean in there now, you know. So that's kind of what the status is. In fact, perhaps you'd like to say something about this.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director of Division of State Land. We did meet with Nick and his group a couple of days ago and talked about kind of the overall plan, what he would need from us. I think we're down to looking at a rule fill issue and how he may be able to excavate around this stern of the ship to facilitate the removal. We have a couple tools in our removal fill law that we were able to, with the assistance of the state legislature last biennium, to get some streamlining done in our emergency permitting authority. And I suspect that we'll look at using that vehicle at least to get them started while we go through the permitting process so they are not held up. And one thing I would like to ensure everybody is that when they're ready, we'll be ready. And because I think we've got the tools in our toolbox to do that. And I'm working with the other state agencies on making sure that we get a coordination meeting going together so we can let everyone know what permits are needed right up front so we can be working on those permits now before they're actually ready to start sometime in June. So we're on it.
Okay. One of the questions that I would like to have answered, and that is, we have the oil spill containment vessel. Is there just one of those stationed in Astoria? Did I have that correctly?
That's correct.
Okay, and who owns that?
Well, I'll take that back. There's actually two oil spill vessels located in the Astoria area. One of them is operated by the MSRC, which is the Oregon Responder. The second one is operated by, I think it's called Clean Pacific, and they used to have a crew boat down there that had some oil boom on board. But there's actually this other vessel is also a seagoing vessel. I think it's a converted mud boat, I believe, isn't it? And it's Jim Rydell is the manager of the outfit. It's Clean Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Jim Rydell's group had a bunch of people working on the beach down here on the new Carissa.
We have one publicly owned and one private? Is that?
They're really both privately held. The MSRC boat is, there was 14 of those built after the Exxon Valdez, and they're stationed, you know, I guess one in Seattle, and Portland, and San Francisco, someplace in California. And then on the East Coast and the Virgin Islands and Hawaii, and the 14 were distributed all over the place. They're all purpose-built vessels, you know, $14-15 million piece-type vessels. And, but their whole purpose is offshore oil pollution pickup.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's what I thought about. Now, who's paying for the maintenance and for the standby charges? For those is that
the MSRC vessel is paid for. I'm not exactly sure what the name of it is. It's funded by the oil companies, though.
Okay, so fees on ship owners. So it's primarily oil producers or shippers.
Yeah, that's correct. The as far as I know, dry ships like the ship carriers aren't obliged to contribute anything. I think it's all this oil pollution capability, or most of it, being funded by the oil industry. Is that correct? Yeah. There's talk of, you know, there's been talk forever of here, let Paul talk to you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Fleiman, Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Nick is right. For the purposes of the MSRC, the large spill response vessels, those are funded by the oil tankers, the oil industry, and they pay into a fund. MPA is the fund in Arizona, and that then is the funding arm for these MSRC vessels. One in Seattle area, the Astoria vessel, two in California, and one in Hawaii. In Oregon, you passed law in 91 that requires the dry vessels, the cargo vessels, to also have some spill response capability. And they have developed that in the Columbia River and in Coos Bay. You may have heard talk about the Coos Bay Response Cooperative and the Maritime Fire and Safety Association in Columbia River. So in Oregon, because of the Senate Bill 242 passed in 91, there is a requirement for some level of spill response capability. Not salvage capability, as Nick is describing, though.
Right, and that's exactly where I was headed, because how many ships actually enter Oregon's waters in any given year? Do we have an answer to that? I see. Okay, Brad has an answer. Okay, you have it too. I bet we have somebody here who knows. Go ahead, identify yourself for the record. And
Paul Amos with the Columbia River Pilot. In the Columbia River, we get about in the neighborhood of 2,000 ship calls per year. Vessel movements per year.
Okay.
This ship's only probably range in the area of 4,000 plus tugs and miscellaneous outside craft that call on the ports.
Okay.
That's not really considered Tuesday or anywhere else.
Let me ask this question. In other parts of the world, do we have situations in which, because we have dangerous waters here, and we have a world-renowned dangerous bar, and certainly some country must, in fact, have a salvage operation standing by with a similar operation to the containment.
I would agree there probably are some. I'm not aware of them. I know that Amsterdam and those areas there are heavy volumes of marine traffic, probably have some of those capabilities, but I cannot identify them specifically.
I believe Australia is one country that has a couple of salvage ships that they maintain. England does it during certain times of the year. England, though, and the ones in Australia are full-time. The ones in England they bring in during the winter months or more dangerous months, and I think they put it out for bid over there or something like that. I think the vessels the last time around were like German or something that came in there. There's a little bone of contention about that with the local industry.
History repeated.
No, there are several other places in the world where salvage is subsidized.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was my initial thought was, as we were watching the days go by, was, okay, what would have happened if we would have had somebody raise the rope? And I know the problem was we couldn't have gotten out the first day anyway, so that presented a major problem.
Senator, I think that had the salvage chief been maintained, fully crewed, the fuel on board, everything, that on that very first day it could have gotten out. The weather, I think it was a little bit marginal, but the thing could have made its way down the coast. It could have got across the bar that day. We were roughly 24 hours from the time I told them to go ahead and get going until we were actually, not quite 22 hours, we were ready to sail. Of course, then we had to wait for the right tide on the bar, so that's how it got to be noon. But
and the weather conditions were deteriorating.
And the weather conditions were deteriorating. So I think in this case it could possibly have made a difference.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because I was... all right. Are there any questions? I don't want to get you between a rock and a hard spot here. When I talked with you the first time after that meeting, I asked the question, what would it cost for us to contract with someone like the salvage chief in order to have that kind of standby potential? And that you mentioned, and this is something the Columbia and the Paul may be able to help us with, and that is, it would appear to me that through the winter months, and of course this year, I mean, that may be 12 months, that is probably the most critical time. That's when the big waves are beating and the ships may break anchor. What do you think it would cost for us to be able to have someone, let's say your company here, on standby during that period of time?
Well,
so that thing was full of fuel, crew was readily available.
We're spending something in the neighborhood of $300,000 a year of our own money to maintain the vessel on station. This is, just plain out of pocket. Nothing for the vessel itself or anything like that. And a couple of years ago, we put together some kind of a deal. In fact, I had some letters that we wrote to Senator Murray in Washington concerning a station in the salvage chief at Nia Bay. And we'd run some numbers. Of course, that's a totally different situation. At Nia Bay, you'd have to have two double crews, so they spend 30 days on and 30 days off up there. You couldn't get people to live there. So a little different deal. The salvage chief at Astoria, which is a desirable place to live, you'd probably get by with just a single crew working 40 hours a week. They were interested in the vessel physically being manned 24 hours a day, but I don't really think that's necessary. If the people lived in the town, you know, you could get out. I think that, I mean, if you're asking me how much money it would take to do it, probably about, you know, $600,000 to $700,000 a year. The number we had for that situation up there was $2.5 million a year to move the salvage chief to Nia Bay. And I haven't had, I know you asked me about this before, but I really haven't had time to do much with it. You know, I've been here hands full.
Senator Shannon.
Okay, I just, I'm going to have to leave, but I wanted to ask a couple questions. Did you get paid for that first day? Remember you said you spent $100,000 just getting helicopters, renting helicopters and all that?
It's kind of you to ask. yeah, we did. We eventually, I mean, we, on the 8th, I think it was, we signed an agreement as a subcontractor to Smith, and we just got paid here a week or so ago. And at the end, I went back, and so we got reimbursed for that.
You were made whole?
Yeah.
Okay, and then I have a second one. And that is, during the fire seasons, you know, we contract with helicopters, whether they go out or not.
Yes, the Bory bombers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's a, I mean, it wouldn't be something that we haven't done before in the state to be prepared. That's all I just
Well, that's exactly what popped into my mind that day was, you know, we do pay substantial fees, Department of Forestry, in order to have those Bory bombers available. And if we could have got out that night, and if we would have been down there, well, you would have been down there on the 5th, wouldn't you, if we could have got out that night?
Yes.
Or been sitting there on the... That was 3 days, 4 days before we actually started that breakup. It could have been a completely different picture. And you know, nobody's trying to place blame here, but we're saying this could happen again. There's no question about it. And that's what I'm hoping comes out of it. And the committee that's going to work on this and hear this further, you'll probably get to tell the story more. I hope they look at this from the standpoint of, okay, I don't want to place blame here, but what are we going to do in the future, and how can we do a preemptive by having the ship ready to roll? Could the ship leave with a 9-member crew and literally be steaming to the location, like down at Coos Bay, and then literally have the rest of the people drive or be flown down there?
Sure you can. The salvage chief has a helicopter deck on it.
I noticed that.
I don't know if the brochure. Did you get one? Did everybody get a copy of the brochure?
Did you bring enough for us?
I think so.
Yeah, that would be
my...
Okay.
Able-bodied assistant will pass them out for somebody.
Well, one thing that bothered me, and I know we have to be really careful with this sort of thing, and I certainly don't want to be quoting, quoted again in the paper saying, well, I'm not too sure what I really want to do here, but there is something that we have an Oregon-based company here that has the capacity to deal with these things, and I just really think that's part of the factor that we need to consider here, and that is... we have the ability to respond. We have the problem ports. We have the problem weather and sea conditions. And I talked to a lot of people who tell me that this is one of the most dangerous places in the world when it comes to the Pacific Northwest seas in the wintertime. And so, I mean, I see this as going to happen. This will happen again. And my thought is, as we joked about before we started, is, you know, the old Boy Scout motto was really correct, and that was, be prepared, be ready. So, I see where it was fun. Go ahead.
Well, it kind of seems to me, I mean, maintaining a salvage vessel is a lot like having a volunteer fire department, you know, and it isn't an economically viable thing to do anymore. My partners are getting a little upset with me for continuing to do it. Every year we have our annual meeting, and there's four companies own the Divine Company, they wonder, well, why do you keep that thing there? You know, it's still the best tool there is to do salvage work. I mean, it's the salvage chief has been about 99% successful in all of the endeavors it's ever tried. And there's only been a few times when we failed, and it really wasn't because of the salvage chief. It was just purely because of weather. I mean, it's just a situation where nothing could be done. There's one additional thing I'd like to throw in about the new Carissa is, we, you know, were told at 6:30 on the 4th that we didn't have a job. there are some other things that could have been done, but I can't speculate too much on them. But there's nothing you can do when you don't have a job. I mean, if you're bringing somebody in from somewhere across the country, they are free to do what they want to do, you know, and like the local contractor doesn't have the opportunity to do much of anything, you know, and offer your services to them, and mm-hmm. But when it got down to us, we were trying to get whatever we could get out of it. You know, we got a few dollars out of it.
Well, I'm thinking about, you know, we have a situation. We have a tanker full of 10,000 gallons of fuel, and it's running down to drop a load at a service station someplace, and all of a sudden, this thing has a wreck. You wouldn't think about calling some foreign insurance company and saying, you know, about 10 days from now, I think I may start cleaning this mess up.
Yeah.
You are required to proceed. Go ahead, would you address that? I mean, let's say, for example, we're talking about that issue of a wreck on a highway or a train wreck involving fuel spillage. What kind of response is required?
Senator George, well, you're absolutely right that should such a wreck occur, they're required to notify both the federal government and Oregon Emergency Management as soon as possible. Generally, that is within a few hours. We know first they have to take care of their own safety, shut off any fuel that's leaking. At this stage in the new Carissa, we had not yet seen any oil leak, and I think that's where there might be a slight difference. They didn't have an oil discharge immediately upon grounding, but not until several days later.
Okay, but my point is, last time we were here, we were told ship stuck in sand or rocks in the high seas will break up, period. That's going to occur. So we would assume there's going to be a leakage. And that's what I'm saying. This is where maybe we need to view. Do you take the next step beyond and say, in seas, with the fact of a grounding, you are going to have a leak. You need to respond immediately. And what I'm asking is, do we have the authority to do that? Because we wouldn't allow the train operator, you know, not to respond. We wouldn't allow the truck loaded with fuel that turned over not to respond. They better be on it quick. What are the implications, for example, if the guy rolls the 10,000 gallons of oil and doesn't do anything? What would happen? You step in, somebody responds.
Senator George, members of the committee, the first responders would probably be the hazmat teams. They generally secure the scene, make sure people are safe. We ensure that the mop-up happens afterwards, we being DEQ, and we have contractors, immediate response contractors that we hire to do that sort of thing. If a responsible party is, for some reason, not cooperative, which isn't often the case, but occasionally, then they can be liable for significant penalties. But we do, once the hazmat teams have secured the scene, we do try and get our contractors there just as quickly as possible to mop up any diesel, gasoline that has spilled at the scene.
Thank you. Senator Shannon.
Oh, I just need to do a little interruption.
Okay.
And that is that my husband, Al's parents, are here from Seattle tonight. Bill Shannon, yes. And we're going to go to dinner, and they'll be with us in the morning on the floor. I wanted to say, Nick, I don't know if I should say thrill, but I'm really happy to meet you because I heard a lot about you and how competent your company is and your ship and all that, and I'm glad you're here tonight. Thank you
very much.
Senator Shannon, I take it you're going to dinner.
Yes, we are.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Senator Dukes.
Probably the one thing that frustrated me the most was the way everything went, and I talked about it with folks at the time, was that the state wasn't in charge.
That's my point.
This was our beach, our waters, our potential disaster, and we were one of the players, but we definitely were not in charge. I went to the director of ODFW at one point and said, why isn't the salvage chief there? It's the only one that can take care of this problem, and you need to call it in. And his response was, I will write that in my report tomorrow morning. That, and then through the process I learned that it was DEQ was the lead state agency, but still did not have the authority to say, do this now. I understand the collaborative process where you bring all the heads together to make the decision, because none of our agencies have all of the, you know, the background they need to be able to decide how to get a ship off the beach. But nonetheless, and it's one of the things I hope to pursue with the task force the governor sets up, is why does the entity with what I consider to be the most to lose — I know there's a lot to lose when you lose a ship, but as you point out, in that sort of situation, ship's pretty much gone anyway — but why are we not in charge? In any other situation, anywhere near similar, we would have been. And it seems to me we have the authority to take control of that situation.
I don't know if you were here when I asked that. Do we have that authority? And that may be whether we ask the Attorney General's office or whoever. That question needs to be asked. And that was one reason we did this right here, because we are in session. And I would like to have, you know, some sort of answer to this, because, you know, the reason I brought up the example, which you have articulated so well, was we wouldn't think about allowing a rail car, a train load of something, or
a
nuclear
truck,
material, or anything else.
A truck that gets beached, that gets caught out in the water by a wave, gets towed away.
Yeah.
And nobody thinks about finding out whether or not the insurance company wants it towed.
Let's use that example. Say a truck does run off the road and out into the surf. What would be the process?
Senator George and Senator Dukes, I think you nailed the process. Were it to happen on the coast, it would very likely be the Coast Guard that would order up the assets to remove the truck. Were it to happen inland, by that I mean, you know, they would first contact the responsible party, the driver of the truck, find out why he or she hasn't moved it out of the beach, but then they would be the ones that would order it up. And it's primarily staffing. They can be much more responsive to coastal spills, and also their jurisdiction is the coast. The inland portions, if the same truck were in a river in the interior part of our state and it were leaking, either it's diesel fuel or it's gasoline, very likely it would be DEQ that would lead hire a contractor to pull it out so it stopped the discharge.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it would be State Parks. Because they own the land. If it were on the beach, they would have an authority to carry it out.
And they would order that no matter what the underwriter was saying. Okay.
It's not going to get buried, but that's more upland.
That's right. Exactly. One of the questions, we're going to assume that Coast Guard has the authority to make this decision. If they don't have the authority to make that decision, can we request them to take that action? In other words, a formal process that would say, under circumstances similar to the new CARISA, the state of Oregon requests the Coast Guard to respond in the following ways. Senator Dukes, you have a lot of knowledge about this. Do we have that authority?
I can't imagine why we couldn't take control or ask the Coast Guard. And the Coast Guard is thinking about responding
to the patient.
Okay. You know, I think my experience has been with the situations like this, that the state is represented through the incident commands, the unified commands through this particular situation with Mr. Zelock. Is that how you pronounce it? Gerlog. So I think that they're considered to be represented. You know, you got the Coast Guard, the state, through Mr. Zerlog, and then you have the owners of the 2I, which in this particular case was Mr. Noe. And then...
Okay, clearly it has the agency and dealing with ship, not the state agency.
Yeah. Actually, the salvers... Once upon a time, ran salvage job. Salvage masters ran salvage job. Now they're about the fifth rung on the ladder, you know, down, you know, and it's. Well, I don't want to beat on that one anymore, but I just think that the incident command system in salvage situations is cumbersome, you know, and if you were dealing with one person, would it be the state, the Coast Guard, or what? And this is what needs to be done. Can we just start doing it? I think that the results would be better.
The process, I mean, the tow trucks are all listed and they rotate, mm-hmm. you know. The ones on the results there. There's an abandoned car.
It should be towed. It's all the next
one on the list. Now, there are out there for ships like this, but, which should make it a little easier to figure out which one to call.
Mm-hmm.
My decision was serious. This is all these people. Was sent back to turn out, but then particularly about the time it landed at Walport.
Then my constituents became very concerned.
Yeah.
So, all right. Then let me ask this question. We'll just go one more, and I want to keep everyone here all night. We were in session in this legislature, and we're not going to be here that much longer. Referring to the agencies, it appears to me, well, are we going to need a bill that says that this is the process, we're going to move aggressively, that this kind of an incident does not occur again? That Senator Deutsch, do you have any suggestion on this?
The only thing I can think of at this point, because it's so late, is that there's a budget note that would indicate
right.
It would be that they should, I would suggest the emergency board to start out with, or to a substantive committee on the costs of setting up a state plan, and the rest of them, you kind of give them verbally that something in the budget.
Mm-hmm.
Get them to go to work and come back.
Well, my suggestion is that it was just that, and I would like to ask this question. Would the members of this committee, and I know Senator Shannon would certainly agree, and I'm sure that Senator Corcoran would, that the last responsibility of this committee would be for us to prepare that letter from this committee stating that based upon what we know, that we request a budget note would indicate that we have this interim plan.
This member of the committee, correct?
Yes. Does everyone agreeable to that? Okay.
Can I say one more thing?
Yes, you certainly can. No, anyone has anything to say, let's hear it.
Would there be any interest in the state of Oregon and the state of Washington, since I was sitting on the Columbia River, being interested in jointly contributing to the salvage industry? Mm-hmm. I feel like a fellow with a tin cup out here, but...
No,
we can talk about pursuing it, but mostly developing the process for response.
Mm-hmm. And look at doing it to Washington State. No, I think that's proven from the committees that I've been involved with in Puget Sound and on the National Academy of Sciences. The industry, particularly the oil industry, thinks they've been hit hard enough, and that people like dry ships should be contributing more, you know, than it's only in more recent times that people are becoming concerned about the fuel in dry ships. I don't think people thought much about what made them go, would be my guess. But incidents like this isn't a tanker, you know, so it comes as a big shock that something besides a tanker can make a mess.
I don't think there's anything that's more sacred to the people of Oregon than that beach. And I keep thinking about it. We have a $300 million DEQ budget. We have an almost $100 million parks budget. Each one of those would, I mean, I'm not suggesting we go in there and pull out $300,000 or $600,000 to maintain a ship on standby. What I'm saying is I think it's very reasonable to ask the question, may it not be in our interest as the state of Oregon to step up to the plate and say, let's be ready to respond. We learned our lesson. Let's not do it twice. And I would, Senator Dukes, all of the members of this committee, I would appreciate the language that you would find appropriate that we could ask our committee as the final action of the committee to prepare, and we'll get that to Senator Farioli. And okay. Are they? With your great knowledge and background on this subject. Okay, would you do that on behalf of the committee? All right. Great. Is there any other questions or comments you made? I certainly appreciate you all coming back in here, and I think we've made progress, and I really look forward to the governor's committee meeting on this too, and maybe with the budget notes and the push from everyone here, we'll end up with something that, first of all, you worry me a little bit when you talk about the fact that the stockholders and the company are suggesting, can we afford to operate this with 10 operations a year? And, you know, before not the door slams closed.
Not 10 operations, Senator, just 10 days.
Oh, 10 days.
You know, that's what the salvage chief's annual utilization in the last 6 years has been, is 10 days of gainful employment per year. So it's not... That's why it's getting to be such a...
3 years.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. And if there's nothing else to come before this committee, we will be adjourned.